Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Jim Loeb of the international news agency Interpress Service, who discusses the links between GOP Senator Tom Cotton and neoconservative activists whose ultimate goal is regime change in Iran. Liz Brown, a St. Louis-based attorney, political analyst, and columnist, who assesses the tense situation in Ferguson, Missouri, after the release of a scathing Justice Department report and the shooting of two police officers during a protest rally. And Donald Cohen, executive director of In the Public Interest, who talks about the negative consequences of prison privatization for inmates and society. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Just north of the disabled Fukushima nuclear power complex in northern Japan, dozens of workers are decontaminating the city of Minamisoma to make it habitable 4 years after a massive earthquake and triple nuclear core meltdowns shut the complex down. The labor-intensive project is the costliest nuclear cleanup ever attempted. The decontamination crews, who wear gloves, masks, and radiation detectors, are spreading fresh soil in yards of empty houses and wiping down gutters and roofs. According to the Los Angeles Times, hundreds of square miles in the Fukushima decontamination zone remain off-limits, and over 79,000 people cannot return home. Unlike the 1986 Chernobyl meltdown, where over 350,000 people were resettled in new communities, Japan is trying to clean up the radioactive zone so families can move back in. In the last 4 years, Japan has spent $13 billion in decontamination work outside the Fukushima complex. But cynicism about the cleanup project is building. Former local official Iwao Hoshi believes the large amount of funds would be better spent resettling residents into new communities. In a sign of progress in peace talks, Colombian President Juan Manuel Santos announced a one-month halt to the government's bombing campaign against rebel bases of the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia. Santos has been in talks with the FARC in Havana, Cuba since 2012, and the two parties recently announced a plan to clear landmines. In recent years, aerial bombing raids have killed some of FARC's top military commanders. The government and FARC have been engaged in a 50-year civil war that has killed over 220,000 civilians. Last December, FARC announced a unilateral ceasefire. The landmine agreement announced in Havana requires FARC rebels to work with Colombian Army soldiers to remove landmines and explosive devices over the next 2 years. More than 11,000 people have been killed by landmines in Colombia over the last 15 years. The International Campaign Against Landmines says the South American country is only second to Afghanistan in the number of children killed or maimed by landmines. The Havana peace talks are now focused on the rights of the conflict's victims, where over 7 million people have been displaced, disarmament of the rebels, and implementation of the final agreement. A year after the recreational use of marijuana was legalized, there is a steady stream of customers shopping at Options Medical Center in Boulder, Colorado, a top seller of legal pot. Despite media hype over legalization, the rate of marijuana use in Colorado has not changed a great deal over the past year. Colorado built its regulatory system for recreational marijuana based on a model developed for the sale of medical marijuana, which was enacted in 2009. Today, 23 states have legalized the use of medical marijuana, and last fall, Oregon, Alaska, and the District of Columbia voted to legalize the recreational use of pot. According to a recent poll, a slim majority of Americans now support the full legalization of marijuana across the country. There is evidence that the black market for marijuana still operates in Colorado, but has decreased after legalization. However, the black market is much larger in Washington state, where the supply of legal pot is limited, taxes are high, and the legal price has been considerably higher than the illegal street price. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
The Republican Party's invitation to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to address a joint session of Congress on March 3rd where he challenged a future international nuclear deal with Iran, was widely criticized for its breach of protocol and failing to notify the White House. But when GOP Arkansas freshman Senator Tom Cotton initiated a letter signed by 47 of his Republican colleagues that warned the Iranian government that any nuclear agreement they signed with President Obama could quickly be overturned by a successor government, a firestorm of criticism erupted across the nation, with dozens of editorials condemning the letter and the appearance of the Twitter hashtag 47 traitors plastered all over social media. Some GOP operatives felt compelled to claim the letter was not to be taken seriously. Ironically, the Cotton letter may have backfired by uniting some wavering Democrats to give President Obama more time to conduct international negotiations with Iran, with the goal of preventing the nation from acquiring nuclear weapons. But legislation sponsored by Republican Senate Foreign Relations Chair Bob Corker that would give Congress 60 days to reject or approve any Iranian nuclear agreement and expedite the consideration of new sanctions if Iran is found to be cheating on the deal, may be voted on in April. By some estimates, the bill is supported by enough Democrats to override a promised presidential veto. Your reporter spoke with Jim Loeb, Washington bureau chief of the international news agency Interpress Service and editor and publisher of theloebblog.com. Here he discusses the links between Senator Tom Cotton and neoconservative activists whose ultimate goal is regime change in Iran.
Cotton, he was elected senator in just this past election. He defeated the incumbent, and he did so with considerable financial support. It was one of the most expensive Senate races in the country. More than $14 million was spent by his direct campaign, of which Paul Singer, who's a major kind of funder of neoconservative, especially Israel-focused neoconservative causes, provided a substantial amount of funding. And in addition, something called the Emergency Committee for Israel, or ECI, which is headed more or less by Bill Kristol, the editor of the Weekly Standard and longtime neoconservative Republican activist, contributed almost $1 million to his campaign indirectly, that is, funded an ad campaign against his opponents on his behalf as part of a kind of super PAC organization. Before he was elected senator, Cotton was a one-term representative from a fairly rural area of Arkansas, which is where he's from originally. However, he went to Harvard and then Harvard Law, and after 9/11, he joined the Army and served for 6 years, including in Iraq and Afghanistan. And in 2006, he was stationed just outside Washington, and he began being cultivated by Kristol himself. They had some teachers or professors in common back at Harvard. Obviously, Kristol saw in Cotton a potential major star in the Republican Party and someone who would adhere to the kind of neoconservative worldview that Kristol has long propagated.
Well, Jim, maybe you could give us some insight as to the goals of the neoconservative movement in Washington today. Many analysts look at these efforts to undermine the nuclear negotiations with Iran by the United States and the permanent members of the Security Council at the UN plus Germany as really leaving no alternative but for military action sometime in the future. I think some of these neocons have made no bones about the fact that they see a future war with Iran as desirable.
There are relatively few who come out and just say we want war, but I think the belief among Iran experts is that if these negotiations collapse, it's unlikely that Iran will return to the negotiating table. And while they're unlikely to radically accelerate their nuclear program in order to build a bomb, tensions are going to rise, and ultimately it could very well result in war. And that's more or less what the Obama administration is arguing as well.
I wanted to ask you about when there was so much controversy about the Cotton letter signed by these 47 Republican senators. What got less attention was the bipartisan support for a bill sponsored by Tennessee Senator Bob Corker, which also provides the Senate some opportunity to vote down any kind of agreement that the Obama administration and its international partners might come up with Iranian nuclear negotiations. Could you say a word about the Corker bill and its possible effect on these negotiations?
Yeah, I think it's important that you have brought it up because, in fact, it poses a much more immediate threat to the negotiations than the letter signed by the 47 senators, simply because it looks like Corker wants to rush it through committee before the 24th of March, or as of the 24th of March. We may not have a deal by the 24th. It could very well take another week to reach such a deal, but Corker seems very, very eager to get something passed, and as the Corker bill is now written, it would definitely undermine the negotiations. The Iranians would be very concerned by its provisions, which include, bringing in issues that have nothing to do with the negotiations themselves. For example, one provision says that if an American citizen is killed as a result of an act of terror that can be tied to Iran, then immediately sanctions will take effect again. Another provision of the bill would deny Obama his waiver authority, that is, his ability to waive sanctions in order to get a deal for a period of 60 days while Congress has a chance to either vote the agreement favorably or unfavorably, which would mean essentially a 60-day period in which everything would be held in suspense. And that would probably be very unacceptable to the Iranians, almost certainly. So they're extremely problematic provisions in the Corker bill that would likely derail the negotiation. And 10 Democratic senators have signed on to that bill as co-sponsors. Obama has pledged to veto the Corker bill if it is passed. And it's very possible that his veto could be overridden, in which case I think then the negotiation would collapse, and then with pretty disastrous consequences. For one thing, I think even our European allies, Britain, France, and Germany, which have been negotiating alongside with us as part of the so-called P5 plus one, even they would probably become completely exasperated and saying, sorry, we're not going to enforce these sanctions any longer, that it's really impossible under these circumstances to reach a reasonable deal. So that legislation is fraught with risk. It's very problematic.
That was Jim Loeb, Washington Bureau Chief of the international news agency Interpress Service and editor and publisher of theloeblog.com. For more perspectives on current nuclear negotiations with Iran, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. A cascade of disturbing events has once again shaken the community of Ferguson, Missouri, following the release of a Department of Justice report examining the conduct of the town's police and courts. On March 11th, just hours after Ferguson Police Chief Thomas Jackson resigned, protesters converged on Ferguson's police headquarters and then shots fired there injured two police officers. The officers were not critically wounded and were both soon released from the hospital. Several days later, on March 14th, police arrested 20-year-old Jeffrey Williams, who they say admitted firing the shots. Williams, who maintains he was not firing his gun at police but another party in a personal dispute, faces several serious charges, including two counts of first-degree assault. Statements made by St. Louis County Police Chief John Belmar, where he described the shooting as an ambush and said the shooter may have been embedded with protesters, have been widely criticized as inaccurate and incendiary. The scathing Justice Department report, which provoked the resignations of Chief Jackson, the city manager, a municipal court judge, and two police supervisors, determined that nearly every aspect of Ferguson's law enforcement system disproportionately impacted African Americans, which regularly targeted black residents for traffic tickets and issued arrest warrants to maximize city revenue. A separate Justice Department report cleared Officer Darren Wilson of any federal civil rights charges tied to a shooting of unarmed 18-year-old Michael Brown in August. Your reporter spoke with Liz Brown, a St. Louis-based attorney, political analyst, and columnist, who assesses the current tense situation in Ferguson and the future of the nationwide Black Lives Matter movement.
It's almost as if this community doesn't really have a time to take its breath. because the issue is so huge what we're dealing with, right? We're dealing with, in light of the DOJ report that came out on Ferguson, and so this community is responding to basically decades of being terrorized. And I don't think that it's even an overstatement to use that word. If you read the DOJ report, you read instances of dogs being sicked on 12-year-old babies, their puncture wounds in their legs for no other reason, according to the report, except being black and being there at the time that law enforcement wanted to do this thing to these children. 90-year-old people being terrorized and being used for bringing money into police to the city of Ferguson. There was a contest with law enforcement who could ticket the most people at one time. And I believe that the largest number of tickets, that it went up to, I think, about 14 tickets in one stop. So you have a community that's reeling from the DOJ report. And right after that, we have the police chief step down. Mind you, a police chief who never responded to, never gave a public comment on the Department of Justice report that was written about his police department under his leadership. He never made a statement about that. And then less than 24 hours after that happened, we have two police officers being shot. So it's a lot. It's a lot for the community to respond to. And what also pushes the response and has an impact upon the response of the community is the fact that law enforcement, this time county law enforcement, when the police officers were shot, county law enforcement's response to that, without evidence, without investigation, without knowledge, the first thing that he says after these two police officers are shot is that this came from an individual embedded with the protesters. That's a provocative, insightful statement that, again, speaks to what African-Americans, people of color, have been experiencing within this community.
After this Department of Justice report on the conduct of Ferguson's police department and courts was released, and many in the protest movement did feel vindicated, what are the demands on the table right now? What are the urgent action items that people who've been involved in this protest movement since August, when Michael Brown was shot by Darren Wilson, what are they urgently calling for?
The remarkable part about what's going on in this region is there are so many people that are responding on so many different fronts. There are people that are responding to the failure of Bob McCullough's office to bring an indictment despite every reason to do so. There are people that are involving themselves on the political front because there are many that believe, and I think accurately so, that the challenge to reforming and changing this community in this region comes from the political activism. So there are people that are actively out there attempting to register people to vote. There are people that are involved in bringing more African Americans onto the City Council of Ferguson. There are people that are actively engaged in reforming how the court systems work, and there are legislators that are filing legislation and advocating for legislation that will no longer allow these small municipalities to get this much money based upon the amount of tickets that they write. So there are fights that are going on all different levels to speak to the challenges that confront this region.
What happened in Ferguson and the complaints, the grievances, both about the conduct of criminal justice in the courts and the situation on the ground for many African Americans in the Ferguson region, they resonated all across this country. And it really gave birth to a new civil rights movement in the view of many observers. I'm wondering, what do you think is next for this movement that really came together over the last several months? Is the momentum still there to push forward? Certainly this Department of Justice report and its revelations about the conduct of police in the courts in Ferguson is not something particular to Ferguson. There are communities all over this country that have similar disturbing practices going on day in and day out. Where are things headed, you think, for this new civil rights movement headed up by some really energetic and creative young leaders these days?
this DOJ report has had the impact of not only confirming for the people who felt that they've never been heard, but it also caught the attention of the press. It caught the attention of those that also helped move this movement, the people that are telling the stories about the movement. So I think it's only going to continue to inspire and ignite other communities to engage in this 21st century activism.
That was Liz Brown, a St. Louis-based attorney, political analyst, and columnist. For more information on groups working to end racial profiling and reform police practices in Ferguson and communities of color nationwide, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In the past few years, many states have undertaken efforts to reform their criminal justice policies and practices, either from a justice perspective or out of concern that the swelling ranks of the incarcerated are breaking budgets. Policy changes across the nation have included early prisoner release before a sentence has been completed and alternatives to incarceration for nonviolent offenders, which provide treatment for drug addiction and/or mental health issues. Just under half of inmates serving time in state prisons are there for nonviolent offenses such as drug possession or forgery. Now, a new study from public policy experts at Dartmouth and the University of Minnesota finds that the higher the concentration of private for-profit prisons in a state, the less likely that state's legislature is to pass criminal justice reform laws. Two corporations, the GEO Group and Corrections Corporation of America, operate the majority of 200 private prisons in 28 states and the District of Columbia. Texas has 62 private prisons, while most other states operate just one. Almost 7% of federal inmates are incarcerated in private prisons, while for state inmates, it's almost 14%. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Donald Cohen, executive director of In the Public Interest, a national research and policy center that focuses on the privatization of public services. The center has issued its own reports on the privatization of U.S. prisons, which are paid for with U.S. tax dollars. Here, Cohen discusses some of the negative impacts of the privatization trend and alternatives that can make the criminal justice system more humane and cost-effective.
We don't actually think private prisons have a role in American criminal justice because the profit incentive is counter to what we need to do to reduce the number of people in prison, to be able to do in prison what we need to do in terms of getting people out with jobs, skills, and good lives, and so they don't come back. One of the main things we think we need to do to reduce the number of people in prison in America is to reduce and remove the power of private prison companies. And we have seen all around the country where private prison companies are engaged, lobby for things that help keep heads in beds because it's in their interest. Private prison companies make money by having people in prison. If you look at their corporate reports of CCA, the Corrections Corporation of America, or the GEO Group, these are the two major prison companies, they include a section that they call risk factors and things that could be a risk to their bottom line. And one of those things is changes in sentencing law. That bottom line, reduced crime is a bad thing, will hurt the private prison companies materially. It will help reduce their bottom line. That's all well and good, but it's not our concern. That's not how we should be running a criminal justice system.
Donald Cohen, what have you found in your organization's own research into privately run prisons?
Well, one of the things we highlighted in terms of private prison companies is we did a research a couple of years back, and we're updating it now, where we analyzed most of the private prison contracts between states and the companies. And what we found is that 2/3 of them had bed guarantees of 80, 90, and 100%. That was the range. In other words, the contract stipulated, keep the beds filled to that amount or pay us anyway. We find that as a real incentive to keep the beds filled, which is really pretty powerful. The last sort of contractual obligation we would want, or any obligation we would want with a private interest whose job it is to make, you know, generate revenue, have that kind of influence over the direction and the outcome of our criminal justice system and the amount of people in prison. It's awful.
And isn't the main argument they use is that private prisons are more efficient than publicly run prisons?
It sounds good, but think about what that means. You have correctional officers, you have prisons, you have food, you have prisoners, and you have programs. I mean, that's what happens in a prison. So, you know, reducing costs mean fewer correctional officers, leading to more dangerous prisons. You reduce program, educational programs, or others, or health care. Or they just cut corners, like to make the food crappier. When they say cost savings are more efficient, they mean that we're going to spend less on things. And so it's really important to look at what that actually means.
What about the prison guard unions? They seem to back their members no matter how outrageously they treat prisoners. Are they a break on prison reform, too?
They have in the past. You know, three strikes in California, where I live, you know, the Correctional Officers Union, CCPOA, was a, you know, was a major supporter of that back in the 90s, like early 90s, I guess it was. But just this past fall, California passed what's referred to as Prop 47, which significantly reduces the number of felonies, turns them back into misdemeanors. And the correctional officers unions did not play a role. They didn't oppose it. I don't think they were engaged in particularly, but it passed quite overwhelmingly. And so what you're seeing is a real change in correctional officers unions, and for the following reasons. Overcrowding is not good for either people in prison or people who work in prisons. Number two is the correctional officers know on a daily basis that our prison system is the country's mental health system. You know, that massive numbers of people in prison really shouldn't be in prison. They should be dealt with in a sane community mental health setting. You know, the correctional officers don't have the skills. They don't think they have the skills. They don't think they should be the one. And so they're beginning to see that there's other things that need to be done. In terms of that. So that's, I think you're seeing a dramatic shift in that. Now, it's also, I should also say, they're really dangerous jobs. We've talked to lots of correctional officers as well and done some research. One of the highest rates of PTSD of any occupation in the country. High rates of suicide, high rates of divorce. It's an awful job.
That was Donald Cohen, Executive Director of In the Public Interest. For more information on the consequences of prison privatization, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine, and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Denise Manzari, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.